Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with Las Vegas-based jazz pianist, producer, arranger, engineer, and music director, Mark Owen. We spent some quality time talking about his long life in jazz, COVID, his new 2022 CD, Respite. It's due out on March 25th, 2022 on Blue Canoe Records, and so much more. And whatever he does, he has a way of bringing his considerable acumen and wide-ranging experience to bear in every professional context. These days, he is currently the associate conductor of Cirque du Soleil. One of his main inspirations is the great Pat Metheny, and he would go on to graduate cum laude from Berklee College of Music, and he's gone on to have a quality life in music. Enjoy.
Well, hey, man, thank you for taking a minute up for the show today. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate the interest. It means a lot.
Oh, yeah, you bet, man. I guess before we really kind of get into your latest project and what's been going on, you know, we're in the midst of COVID and hopefully coming out, hopefully live shows, the opportunity to promote this in a live environment. What does this release overall mean for you right now?
I've been sitting on some of this for quite a few years because I've spent the majority of my time working for other people, you know, as either a sideman, a keyboard player, or a producer. In fact, a good friend of mine, I produced his last record, is from Kansas City. He was big in the jazz scene for a while there. Bill Caldwell, I don't know if you know him.
Yeah, I do know Bill, absolutely. Yeah, he's wonderful.
But, you know, sadly, he is no longer with us. I can't really say what it means. I mean, it comes on the heels of another thing that I did that was a duo project, but this is the first time I've ever really gone out as a composer, per se. I'm just glad that it's done and that it's out there. I don't really expect much from it because instrumental music has always been relegated to kind of a niche, and this is a niche of a niche because it doesn't really have a home, which is why it took me so long to come to terms with it. I mean, it isn't quite jazz. It isn't quite this. It isn't quite a lot of things. And, you know, everybody wants to categorize everything these days. So I'm kind of a man without a home. So I'm just glad it's done and it's out there.
Well, I guess that's the follow-up to this. You know, what do you ultimately hope, no matter what the classification is or whatever anybody thinks, the idea is that you get it into willing ears to listen to it. What do you hope listeners get from this?
All of it is about something, and I have always very much wanted to just reach people emotionally with the music. And I know that sounds kind of passé, but that's honestly what I want to do. I want people to hear it, and I want them to be able to just kind of drift away from whatever is going on. You know what? When I was a kid, I spent a lot of time, both me and my friends, spent a lot of time just listening to records. You know, we would get together for the day and sit around and just listen to records, not talk, just listen. And it was always, not to be corny, but it was always a respite for me. It was always a place where I could go, and it was happy, and I enjoyed it, and it meant a lot to me and influenced me deeply enough so that I have made a living and a career out of it. So I very much want it to be just what the title is. I want it to be a respite. I want people to be able to put it on and go away for an hour and not worry about anything else and just be a part of whatever that soundscape is.
Yeah, I get it. And I think that's one of the arts that have been lost in our modern dash to ultimate technology, is that, you know, that's not something that happens often because people can cherry pick. I mean, I got a turntable about 6-7 years ago and really kind of rediscovered that vinyl warm sound and just that whole idea of getting immersed in that one event, that one album. And I think, I dig it. I think that's something that should happen and would be a much more pleasant listening experience for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up, I got a lot of my records from one of my uncles who's only 10 years older than me. He was an accident for my grandmother and came late in life. And whenever we'd go over to his house, you know, at my house with my mother, I wasn't allowed to touch the stereo, you know, and we were, I don't know, 9 or 10 before we got our own cheap little record players, you know. But when we went over to my uncle's house and he had, you know, his downstairs was a whole two walls of cinder block shelves and albums, and his stereo was like the centerpiece of the downstairs. And we could go over there, and I was allowed to just play records. And I'd go downstairs and put on headphones and go through his record collection. And, you know, I got a lot of my records from him. So that was like, that was my thing when I was a kid.
You know, I guess the other thing that I want to kind of touch on in regards to modern times and, you know, this new album, you know, during this COVID time, we've all had time to be alone, quarantine time, and to figure things out. What did you learn about yourself that maybe you didn't realize before this that is just going to make you stronger as you get out and promote this new album and hopefully get to a live playing environment more and more?
Well, as far as getting into a live playing environment, I mean, I've been making my living on stage since I graduated in 1990. So I have no great desire. I mean, it was actually kind of nice to have a break. You know, I don't know if you've seen that meme that says how you feel when you realize your regular life is called quarantine. Because the only difference for me was I didn't go do the shows 5 days a week.
Yeah.
Because I normally get up and have my tea, do the crossword and work out and then go into the studio. And so when I didn't have to leave for the shows, that just meant I could stay in the studio a few hours longer. It was great to be free, but it really wasn't that different for me, except that I didn't have any clients because, you know, not only did everybody have no work, musicians especially didn't have any work. And they especially didn't have money to spend on getting somebody to produce anything for them. So suddenly with no clients, I was free to do whatever I wanted for 19 months.
And I think that's been something that's been a little bit more, I've heard it much, much more from musicians that were very busy before this, that it was almost relieving to have that moment to kind of reflect and step back and look back at their life and say, man, I was running too hard for too long, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
So one of those silver linings, I think, of this pandemic that we're going to look back on and realize. But, you know, you're a very creative human, and you've been in the act of creating for a long, long time. And I'm curious how all this began, kind of where you were born and raised and what your family life was like to get to the point where this is your passion.
I am from Virginia. I was born and raised. I was actually born in Manhattan, because my father was still getting his master's at Union Theological Seminary, but we left when I was like 6 months old, so I don't even count that. And we went to Virginia, where my family is from, and that's where I grew. I grew up outside of D.C. in Falls Church. I actually traced my family back in Matthews County as far back as 1774, which was really bizarre.
Wow.
But my father was a musician. He had his degree in sacred music, and played in old school, you know, wore the gown, played a huge pipe organ, and that was actually one of my first musical experiences. He took me into the, you know, and this was one of those churches that had the big pipe organ where the entire back wall of the church was the pipes, right?
Yeah.
And there's a room underneath that where the pipes actually open up, and that's where the sound originates. He took me back in that room and sat me in a chair and then went and played the organ. And it just blew me away because it was so loud. But he died when I was really young. He tried to get me into playing music, and I wasn't having any of it. And he died when I was in fourth grade. And almost immediately after he died, I picked up the trumpet. And picked up the trumpet, and then the drums the year after that, and then piano the year after that. And, you know, my mom was very supportive. She took me to trumpet lessons and piano lessons once a week. You know, this is rush hour on the Beltway in D.C. on Mondays and Fridays. And it was just as much a career choice as if I had said I wanted to be a doctor to her. And she supported it, and that laid the foundation. You know, and then I got out of high school, dropped out actually, played in rock bands for 5 or 6 years. And that was enough of a wake-up call for me to realize that I wanted, you know, somewhere along that line, I heard stuff like the Dixie Dregs and Pat Metheny, and I was like, holy shit, what is this stuff? And that led me down another road of listening, and I just started to get the itch of, you know, what are these chords? What are these sounds? And I realized I needed some further formal education. I quit the whole bar scene and the cover band scene and started working as a commercial fisherman on Chesapeake Bay and saved my money and went to Berkeley and got educated.
So what were some, I mean, especially for the purposes of this being a jazz show, who were some early jazz influences that kind of swayed the way that either you were going to approach your craft or get your voice?
Oh, well, that's easy. Pat Metheny. I mean, actually, I have to say the first thing I ever heard was in 10th grade. I heard Pat Martino's Joyous Lake. And that just blew my mind. That was the first time I had ever heard somebody who had a what would be considered a traditional straight-ahead bebop background, but playing in an electronic quartet, you know, keyboards, bass, drums, guitar, with synthesizers. And that just floored me, man. And I think the next thing I heard that was the same kind of experience was Pat Metheny, both the American Garage album at one point and later on the Off-Ramp album. And both of those were huge. And I grew up listening to Oscar Peterson, George Shearing, but that was my mother's music, you know, along with the classical stuff. But those were the first things that I heard that made me seek the stuff out on my own and be like, oh my God, what is this? What are these sounds? What are these chords? What's going on here? And then when I got to Berkeley, somebody played Standards Live for me one night, and that was another light bulb moment. You know, that was the beginning of going down the road of, oh my God, why am I even here?
Yeah, when this pandemic began in January 2020, living in the Kansas City Metro, I actually moved to Pat Metheny's hometown. So it's almost like when you buy a car and then you recognize that car all the time. Like,
right.
I hear all of the Pat Metheny stories, and I'm just, you know, my stepdaughter goes to the high school he came from, and I'm in that auditorium. She's in plays and stuff, and I just think, man, he was just this kid, didn't know what was going on, and now he's like, you know, he's getting up there next to Charlie Parker and being that famous in Kansas City. So
sure,
worldwide, sure. You know.
I've got an interesting Pat Metheny story. Our first year at Berkeley, one of the girls who was in our circle, because this is in 1986, right? And this is back when phone books were still a thing. He was in the book, man. I think he lived in Cambridge. I may have that wrong. But she came to us one day, and she's like, I called Pat today. And we're like, what? She said, yeah, his number was in the book. And I called him and asked, would he come talk to us? And we're all like, sure you did. Of course you called Pat Metheny. And she said, no, he said he's leaving on his South American tour, but I should call him in the spring. And we all blew it off like, yeah, you know, have another drink. And in the spring... In the spring, she comes up and says to me, hey, I called Pat back, and he's going to come talk to a bunch of us. Do you want to be there? And, of course, I said, yes, are you insane? Of course I want to be there. The guy is the reason I'm at this college. And so I think about 20 of us, maybe more, went over to some kid's studio apartment on Beacon Street. And here comes Pat, man. You know, just dressed like he always is, you know, in jeans and that horizontally striped shirt, hair out to here, running shoes with no socks. This guy was my hero, and he comes into this apartment, and he sat down and talked to a group of random strangers, random music student kids, for 4 hours, man.
Wow.
Until it was just silent, and kids were out of questions. And then he was like, okay, well, I guess we're done here. Thanks for having me, guys. You know? And it just was, it was such a profound impact on me to have somebody, you know, here's the greatest living guitar improviser on the planet. Yeah, sure, I'll come talk to you, a bunch of kids. No problem. You know?
Yeah.
And it was not only a lesson in, you know, how to be as a musician, but a lesson in how to be as a human being. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And somebody asked him, what are you thinking about when you solo? And he's like, well, man, just trying not to suck. And I was like, God damn, man, trying not to suck. Aren't we all, right?
Yeah, I've heard so many stories like that, how accessible he is, how open he is, and just kind of a guy, you know, and he's
right,
you know, just doing his thing, but he has this talent, and I think there's a lot of people that are like that on the planet that just have this talent that we're all like, holy shit, but it's just who they are. That's just who they have become, you know.
Right.
So it's quite refreshing. So I guess on that vein of seeing something live, what was the first live show that you saw in your life that blew you away?
It was probably a symphony. My mom had season tickets to the Kennedy Center, and I think she took me to see, and I couldn't even tell you who it was, you know, but it was a concert of Beethoven at the Kennedy Center. And,
wow,
you know, I just remember sitting there just knocked out. I mean, you know, I couldn't have been more than 9 or 10, you know, in my little stupid suit with my platform shoes, because it was the 70s, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was the first time, and I was just like floored by something. I mean, because, you know, a symphony up close is a pretty impressive thing to hear.
Yeah, I was just kind of thinking about Bill, and I remember now, it was around 2013 or 14 that he passed?
Yeah, it was shortly after I moved here when I got word. We were actually in discussions for his next record.
Okay. Because I was thinking about that time, because I remember profiling him on the show, and, you know, in it, there's a mention of Bob Bowman and Todd Strait and some others.
Right.
So what was it like? What was your kind of connection to Kansas City and the memories that you have with those musicians and Kansas City?
Well, my connection isn't really with Kansas City. My connection was purely with Bill, because I wound up through circumstances in Branson. And I was in Branson for 14 years doing a show. I had a kid to raise. I was just looking for a creative outlet. And so I had put the word out to some of the people that I knew in town, hey, who's the best tenor player in town? Because this was still when they had a show at the Lawrence Welk Theater. They had Les Brown's big band. I mean, Les Brown's Band of Renown, his big band was still in town. There were still like horn player gigs, you know. And everybody came back with the same name. Everybody said, Bill Caldwell. And a couple people also said, oh, but you two would kill each other. He had a reputation as being pretty much a hard ass. And I reached out to him and told him what I was looking to do. I was looking to put together a little quintet and play some jazz. And he came over to the theater where we were working for a rehearsal just to check things out. And man, we hit it off immediately, and we were best friends immediately. We both had the same outlook, both loved the same music. And we kept that quintet going for about a year, until it was just such a hassle, because everybody was doing shows. So everybody would like run to this one place where we played after the shows, and breaking down their gear and schlepping it to this place. And I think we were all making like $40 for doing that. I think the guy who owned the bar just stopped it, because lots of people were coming to hear it, but nobody was really, you know, lots of people that were coming to hear it were under 21, because it was a restaurant too. So he wasn't making a whole lot of money. So
yeah,
that went to the wayside. And it was shortly after that that we got together in the studio, and he asked me to produce that record, because I think he did a version of that record in Kansas City, because Bob Bowman was playing bass and Todd Strait was playing drums on the record. And it was a piano player and a trumpet player. I think Jay DeVersa was playing trumpet. And I don't know who the piano player was, but he was never really happy with the way the record came out. And so he brought it to me. He got all the Pro Tools files and brought that stuff to me. And we basically stripped it down to just the bass and the drums. And then we redid everything else from the ground up. So it was kind of interesting, because it had a lot of requirements. You know, it wasn't, we had to produce around what had previously been done while still trying to create something new.
You know, you've been at this for quite a while in a lot of different facets. And I'm curious, what do you like the best about your day job? What do you like the best about being a creator and doing what you do on a daily basis?
It always feels like I'm looking for an answer to a question that can never really be answered. You know, every day is like that question is there waiting for an answer. And every time you go sit down at the instrument or sit down in the studio, I feel like I'm looking for an answer. And when something does come and it wraps itself up eventually, however long that takes, you kind of feel like you have maybe not the answer, but an answer. And I feel that that's very gratifying. But at the same time, it never really ends, you know, because as you answer, I get this answer, and then the question kind of changes. You know, the further along down the road you go, I always tell people that it never really ends because, like, when you start, you're here. Your skill set is at the bottom, and your perception is only slightly above that, you know? And then let's say after 5 years, your perception is way above where it was before. I mean, your skill level is way above where it was before, but your perception is exponentially greater. So the better you get and the more you know, what you understand is way beyond what you can actually do. And the harder you work at it, the greater the distance between the two. Like when you started, you just wanted to, oh, hey, man, I just want to learn how to play Stairway to Heaven. You know, and once you get to the Stairway in Heaven, then you realize, oh, okay, well, that's easy. What I really need to do is I need to learn Pat Martino's solo off of this song. And then once you get there, oh, that's great. I've got that. But now it's this. And it never really, the two never meet. It's kind of like an addiction, really. I mean, I don't recommend it.
Well, let me take this a step further. Let's say you have a dream tonight and you run into the younger version of yourself around the time you graduated and starting to, you know, get on that path to become a professional. If you run into your younger version and you give your young version one piece of advice based on what you've learned throughout all of these years, what are you going to tell that version of you?
I would probably tell that younger version of me to not forget what made you fall in love with this in the first place. Because that, I had to take a very long circular journey to get back to that, you know? Like, going to college, going to Berkeley was amazing. And I was, it's the only time in your life that you'll ever be around that many people that are precisely focused on exactly what you love. You know what I mean? But by the same token, I got my ass kicked when I went to Berkeley. When I was there, Jeff Keyser was there, Scott Kinsey. I mean, there was just a laundry list. Roy Hargrove, Donnie McCaslin, there's just a laundry list of lots of people who are who's who. And a lot of those cats were, I wouldn't say fully formed, but pretty much full of Kurt Rosenwinkel. No, they were crushing it when they were there, you know? And I was just some random music student from Virginia, and I'm like, what the hell is going on? And along with the ass kicking comes the education. And that you have an enormous amount of information crammed into your head during those 4 years. And it takes a lot longer than those 4 years to assimilate all of that. You know, and along with the assimilation and all that information comes the directives that, you know, you should be like this or you should be like that or you can do this or you can't do that. And it was very difficult for me to come to terms with what I wanted to do musically. And it was very hard for me to come to terms with, okay, I want to write this piece of music like this. Okay, well, you know what? That's not jazzy enough, or that's not out enough, or that's not, what would Chick Corea think of this? You know, if it's not, if it's not tearing it up, oh man, that's just not happening. You know, you get caught in that trap. And it took me a long time and a lot of having to realize other people's vision before I was like, okay, you know what? This is valid. It's okay for me to do this. It's okay for me to love this, even if this is somewhat simple sounding. You know what I mean? I think that's tough, especially for young musicians, to have any sort of vision when you are surrounded, when everything you're surrounded with is so much better than you and so high pressure.
So everyone has a perception of you, your family, your friends, your fans, but ultimately you live your life. You have a perception of you. Who do you think you are?
I would hope that I'm a decent human being, a good husband, a decent father. I would hope that I'm competent in what I do and that, you know, I leave love in my wake. That's kind of like my own little mantra.
Yeah, I like it, man. Mark, hey, thank you for taking some time out to talk about the new material, your life in music. I really appreciate it, man.
Yeah, I appreciate the interest, Joe. I really do.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players and minds in Virginia, Las Vegas, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Mark for his time, music, and story. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com, and for everything Neon Jazz all the time, go to the NeonJazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.